Pardon the interruption. I just want to tell you about a video that I want you to check out. It features the one and only Chuck Norris. You remember Chuck Norris? The man's in his 80s. And, you know, I'm no spring chicken. Nonetheless, I care about my health. I want to live a long time. I want to be healthy. I don't always get as many fruits and vegetables and herbs that are supposed to increase my energy levels in my own diet. So I saw this video that Chuck Norris has made. He's kicking butt. He's working out. He's staying active. He has heaps of energy left over for his grandkids and so on. And he says that he is achieving all this by making one single change. And he feels like he's in his 50s. Go to mymorningkick.com/Josh and watch Chuck Norris's video right now. That's mymorningkick.com/Josh, mymorningkick.com/Josh. G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. And if you think that I sometimes get into trouble for expressing unconventional, heterodox ideas on this show, then you haven't heard Jimmy Carr, who gets into a lot of trouble for telling jokes about similar issues. He's one of the most important, influential, most watched and funniest comics in the world. He's one of the top-selling stand-up acts. He plays to arenas all over the place. He regularly appears on British television shows like 8 out of 10 Cats and QI, Big Fat Quiz of the Year. His recent tour, Terribly Funny, was seen by more than 1.2 million people in 45 countries. It was the biggest international stand-up tour in the history of the world. He has a new Netflix special called Jimmy Carr, Natural Born Killer. I was recently in London, and Jimmy, I'm pleased to say, is a fan of this show, a fan of yours truly. He did us the honor of renting out a little room in an exclusive Mayfair club, and we sat down together. It was such a delight to pick his brain about cancel culture, about what you can and can't say, about the state of the world, about social media. Please enjoy as much as I did. The one, the only, the legend, Jimmy Carr.
So you're...
I'm here with Josh, he's sunburnt.
Yeah. And dressed as Top... If you are dressed as... It's a very Top Gun jacket. It's very... And look, we all saw the movie and went, do you know what? I could probably pull that off. I probably look all right in that.
But only I actually took the extra step and went out and said, give me your finest Tom Cruise jacket. And before we started recording,
very,
you were saying...
Very nice guy. I met him at a friend's wedding and kind of bumped into him. And he's very engaging. Right. Very engaging character, very kind of very genuine, and got into an interesting conversation with him.
What about?
Because he did Eyes Wide Shut with Stanley Kubrick. And Stanley Kubrick, I don't know if you know, but the reason he was able to make that movie Barry Lyndon was because he had the lenses from NASA. So he was able to shoot a movie basically on candlelight. No one could figure out how this guy done it. I mean, greatest film director of his generation, but no one could figure out how Barry Lyndon was made. Like the other directors were going, well, this is just incredible.
Uh-huh.
And it was because he had these incredible lenses, the best lenses that have ever been made by humanity. Well, how did he get those lenses? It's not like after Apollo 13, NASA had a yard sale and got rid of their stuff and he happened to buy them.
Right.
So the theory is that Stanley Kubrick was the greatest director in the world. NASA was a project in the middle of the Cold War in order to beat the Russians. That was the purpose of it.
Yeah.
How do they put a man on the moon?
Right.
You know what their resource was?
Well,
unlimited. Their budget was unlimited. NASA said, well, what's our budget? And they went, unlimited.
Whatever you want.
Anyone you want, anything you want, you got it.
Right.
So the theory is Kubrick filmed the B-roll. So they did film a fake version in the desert, but that was the rehearsal. You think they didn't rehearse. You work in media. You think they didn't rehearse. They rehearsed the whole thing, shot for shot for shot. He's obviously uncredited. What does he get as payment? The lenses.
He gets the lenses.
And then, so I asked Tom Cruise about this. Right. And went, were the lenses from NASA? And he went, how'd you know that? Yeah, they were.
Did he?
Yeah.
That was quite a good Tom Cruise impression as
Thank
well.
Thank you, yeah.
That kind of scary stare.
Thank you. I can do scary.
You can do scary.
I don't want to talk about the Illuminati or my Scientology connections. Everything else is fair game. Go.
Is he a very intense person? Does he feel like his eyes are burrowing into the...
Honestly, I don't know the guy. I met him for 15 minutes once and he was incredibly charming, very engaging.
Don't downplay your ability to judge a person's character, Jimmy Carr.
I think he seemed like a very, very nice guy.
That's all you're going to say?
Yeah.
You're afraid of him.
Huh?
You're afraid of him.
God damn it.
You, with all your Illuminati connections, yeah, and you're I'll still start, afraid. Yeah.
It's a good name drop story to start with,
isn't it? Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Who else have you got? You've got a lot. You have a lot of
got
name
loads.
Drops.
I've got a lot. I tell you what, it's a pleasure meeting you. It's I'm loving it. I'm loving meeting you now as well, because yeah, I'm a big fan of your podcast, but the idea that it's what, 3-4 months since, yes, you left?
Yes.
And you've kind of left mainstream media and done this. I think it's such a... It's so right for you. It feels like it's exactly the right move. I mean, it must be a bit daunting, could be kind of free-floating.
It is. It's and weird left when you is go also from... a very generous way of articulating the relationship between me and my former employer.
But it's those great addictions, the greatest addictions. It's heroin and a monthly salary.
Yes.
The monthly salary is very difficult to get, you know, when you leave.
Absolutely.
And then you can't turn anything down for the first couple of years. Mm. I'm still in that phase now where you go, look, you know, there's rich and there's wealthy.
Yeah.
And, you know, rich people get paid a lot of money to turn up and do a show. But to turn one down,
right,
I can't even conceive of that.
Come on.
If someone books me
You're
for a show, I'll go, I'll
wealthy.
Be there. But I'll turn up for the show. The right. work ethic thing right. of going, no,
Did
turn
you
up.
Ever want to have a job?
I had a job.
What was your job?
I worked for an oil company. I worked for Shell Oil for a couple of years, yeah.
Get
I had, like,
out.
A proper job. I think it's quite important as well, because that thing of the hedonic treadmill, we get very used to our lives being good.
Yeah.
So you need something to anchor you.
Yeah.
You kind of need the school years or the college years or the work years. If you're in show business or doing anything creative, you need something to judge it against.
Yes.
To go, well, that was really boring.
Yeah.
And now I do this thing and it's really fun.
Mm.
And, you know, that kind of thing of, I think that the gratitude, some people in showbiz or whatever, they what's the phrase I like? Pressure is a privilege. If you do a job where you're under pressure, that's pretty great.
Yes.
You don't, you've got a career. You haven't got a job.
Yeah.
That's kind of amazing, right? Very few people get to breathe that rarefied air. And so I get kind of sick and tired of people complaining about it.
Now you're sounding almost a bit like a self-help guru.
Yeah, that's my vibe.
Which is, you know, like...
That's very much my vibe.
You
know,
if
on
you
podcasts,
do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
I kind of
that's
believe
the
that,
sticker, Jimmy
Yeah,
Carr.
But I kind of... I believe in all that
it's
stuff.
True.
I think it really helps as well. That the problem with self-help is that thing... I wrote a biography a couple of years ago, which was basically a self-help book. And it's that thing of, like, the Eckhart Tolles of this world. It's all correct, but it's very po-faced. It's very dry.
Right.
They don't do dick jokes.
Yeah.
And I think you need somehow to... You need to sugar the pill of the self-help stuff.
Right.
Because it is very useful. Like, reframing stuff is... Like, perception isn't reality.
Yes.
But it's everything. It's how we see the world is how the world is.
Given that I've consumed most of Eckhart Tolle's writings... Oh, yes, Ollie.
Sorry, just... Because the way the line is, when you look at news side of this, where we get some strange shadows on you.
Like that? So keep it over here. Brilliant. All right. I'm going to lean like this. Thank you. Given that I've consumed most of Eckhart Tolle's writings as audiobooks with him talking gently in my ear, I really want to hear the dick joke now.
Well, no, but
hear him going...
Yeah, but that thing of...
The penis.
It's a weird thing with the audiobook as well. I find the audiobook weird because I listen to everything at like times 3 the speed.
Oh, don't do that.
But it's like everything, every bit of wisdom I've ever heard sounds like a chipmunk said it.
Right. Imagine if people were listening to your routines at 3 times speed. You don't really listen to things at 3 times speed.
I do listen to things very fast.
Doesn't that drain the sort of the charm and the character out of the people who are reading it to you?
It does a little bit, but I suppose it's that thing of like just taking
You're a fast man.
It's not like you're listening to Dostoevsky, or it's not like you're listening to a beautiful novel at 3 times the speed, trying to consume poetry at pace. But for stuff that's nonfiction, I think it's pretty valid.
And speaking of saying yes to everything, you've been racing around like a blue-ass fly, as we might say in Australia.
Yeah. Busy
you're
week.
What have you been doing?
I was in South Africa last weekend. I did like Cape Town and Joburg.
Wow.
What, Pretoria? That was pretty fun.
Yeah.
And then I went to Paris to see a show. I took a night off, went to see a show, and then I did Istanbul for a couple of nights. Very fun.
Great.
And then did Budapest, and then did Vienna. Just got back this morning.
What do they make of you in Istanbul? Or is it expats?
They liked it. No, it was all locals. And it was very...
You're doing it in Turkish, obviously.
Of course, yes.
Like
it's interesting.
Eddie Izzard goes and does all these tours. You know, Eddie Izzard does his entire routine in German, and then does it in French. And
I mean, I read a report on it years ago. I've never really... When I toured Germany, no one's talking about it. So I guess maybe.
I'm trusting Eddie.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Susan,
why would she lie?
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, but I know I travel sort of everywhere. It's amazing the English language. The thing that's kind of remained from, you know, people talk about the end of the British Empire.
Yeah.
You know, no. The language.
Right.
The language is the thing that we've... It's everywhere.
Mm.
And I think the last 10 years, the language has got better globally. I mean, I really notice it when I go to places. People just get things immediately. And I think it's like YouTube and Netflix.
Yeah, right.
And maybe podcasts as well. The idea that people
are... OnlyFans.
Maybe. But they're consuming sort of media that isn't, it's not being mediated by Canal Plus.
So
it's the version original. Yeah. And everyone's kind of, you have to learn English if you want to be interested in the culture.
Mm.
So that kind of cultural imperialism is kind of, is making the world a very small place.
Good. Newsflash, Jimmy Carr in favor of imperialism.
Yeah.
You heard it here first. You know what the Daily Mail will make of that?
They'll be all right with it.
I don't know. They don't seem to be all right with anything. How do you workshop material these days? So you're basically workshopping, right? Or do you have your whole routine at the moment?
I've got a new... So the new tour starts the day the Netflix special comes out.
Great. So which is when people will hear this as well, by the way. So if they're thinking about your past week, don't think about Jimmy's past... That was 6 weeks ago.
Ages ago. So it's basically that thing of the... the treadmill I'm on is you write to the deadline of the new show, the Netflix thing drops, Natural Born Killer. It's pretty good. It's the best thing I've ever done.
Is it?
But it's good. You get better at your job, right? Obviously, over time. We'll talk about that. But it's and then the new one the next day. So there's no gap between tours. So you tour that and then you do the new. But I test stuff every single night of the show. That's the big innovation that I had the last kind of 2 years of going every single night, try new jokes.
Yeah, right.
So it's that thing. It's quite stoic. Like, do less, better. Yeah, just write jokes. That's kind of... I suppose the world ordered a stand-up comedian, and I need to honor that. I think you can spend a lot of time in show business kind of looking elsewhere, looking for other fun things to do and distractions.
Mm.
But actually sticking to the thing that you're good at is kind of best.
I once interviewed Stephen King, who was talking about his routine of just getting up in the morning, sitting down, and writing or not writing, but as long as he was just sitting in front of the computer with watching that flashing cursor blink at him, then the job is done. Sometimes it'll come, some days it won't come.
Yeah.
As long as you put in the time, you do the work consistently, day after day.
I'm 100% with it. His book on writing.
So good.
It's phenomenal. And it's not necessarily, I mean, if you've got no interest in writing novels, but the idea of going, that work ethic of going, we'll do the thing.
Yeah.
What's actually doing the thing?
Yeah.
And for me, it's jokes is that's always going to be my love language. Although it was changed up a bit for this special. There's some kind of longer routines in it. And I'm trying to get better at, I'm trying to have some different clubs, I suppose. Like I've got a fastball. I'm good with one-liners.
Yeah.
But it's trying to have longer routines or stuff that kind of makes a point along the way. It's like really, it's interesting to kind of play with that. To get better after doing it for sort of 25 years is really interesting. And to sort of see the progress.
Yeah. How do you judge the progress?
I think you judge it on... I judge it on laughs and applause breaks. I judge it on, like, when you do a show, what can you make... can you change people's states?
And have you ever recorded your shows and listened back to try to analyze them, like some forensic...
I mean, I'm obsessed by that.
Yeah.
It's like the level of kind of detail and you know, the weeds on... Like, I'll sort of go through the show. I'm just going through the new one now.
Yeah.
And I'm analyzing it for joke type. To make sure that nothing comes, there's like 50 joke types, roughly, and making sure that nothing repeats. Because the audience never realize, he's done 3 pullback reveals in a row. The third one doesn't get as much. But if you move them around, it's you can't play the same tricks. Why some stand-ups are boring to watch, because they're you know, 1 or 2 trick ponies.
Right.
And they do the same joke type over and over.
What's
the
audience, pullback reveal?
The pullback reveal? Where you sort of, you're telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all jokes essentially work in the same way. So all jokes, are 2 stories. And in the first story, you're forced to make an assumption that turns out to be erroneous in the second part of the story, the punchline. So it's the sudden revelation of a previously concealed fact. And a pullback reveal is just a very obvious way of doing that, where you're focusing here and then you pull back.
I see. So it's like a wider lens.
Yeah, the situation changes at the end. So
can you think of an example?
I could probably do nothing clean enough to repeat.
This is a pretty dirty show. I mean, you can get away with that.
Mm. Yeah, it's but that thing of like analyzing the joke types and all that weeds, it's fun.
Speaking of the just going back to the Stephen King book, do you know The War of Art? You know, it's the same thing about like being a pro versus being an amateur. Like, you know, a professional just takes it seriously, grinds it out, doesn't talk about what they're doing.
He's the artist Chuck Close. Do you know Chuck Close?
No.
He's a great visual artist, and he said, inspiration is for amateurs, the rest of us go to work.
Right.
Love that.
When did you learn that?
I think pretty early on. I was kind of mid-20s when I discovered comedy, and it was that thing of like going, this is good. this is good. And I kind of felt like it was a bit like Indiana Jones getting his hat back. I felt like I've got a shot at this, but it's quite a small shot. Like, I should really put myself into this 100%. Mm. So I just did a lot of gigs. And it was that thing of like, it just what feels like play to you, but looks like work to others.
Yes.
And it just felt like play to me. It felt like very easy to kind of apply myself. And so suddenly, I think work ethic is kind of a weird thing, work ethic, because it's not like, it's not across a wide spectrum of things. Like, you know, you can give me physics homework all day long. I won't be interested in it. But if it's writing jokes, I can do that. I can kind of focus on that thing. So finding kind of the right stream for you.
And when you say writing jokes or like trying out new material on this tour, does that mean that there's a time of day where you sit down and you think, I'm going to start writing some jokes? Or does it mean that you have a flicker of thought in your head and then you try it out on stage that night, or what?
The flicker of thought is you sort of note those down constantly, anything that occurs to you. And then really the writing is the editing. So I'm probably not the greatest writer, but I'm a good editor. Mm. So I'll generate a ton of material and then be able to edit it down and sort of and decide what's going to work. And then the audience is a genius. The great thing about my job, as opposed to your job, like you do a podcast, you're slightly whispering into the abyss. You get some feedback, but it's weeks later and it's, you know, so, oh, I like the show, but it's very broad. Mm. Whereas I get feedback on every line and it's binary. They either laugh or they don't, and they're right. And then so you can sort of tinker with it and change it and, okay, so what can we do with that to get a bigger laugh, or to you just go, it doesn't work as an idea. Sometimes it's just, even after 25 years, sometimes you think, oh, this is going to be great.
Right.
Nothing. Just a sentence. Just looking at you bemused. And then I always test it like after about 90 minutes on stage. So you kind of, you've done your end bit, the big thing, and then you go, right, new jokes. And if it doesn't work there, then do you really want it in the next show? Mm. So like there's like a ton of B-grade material that you generate that's just like, who cares? Well, topical stuff, you go.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember when you started sort of realizing, wow, I'm not just sort of able to do this, but I'm getting an incredible reception and I'm starting to reach a level of success? Was that going to Edinburgh in 2001? Was that?
Yeah, I would have thought it was probably around then. Like the idea of like, you sort of did it, you could do, it's weird, the little steps along the way. There's a lot of incremental steps of like, you know, doing 5 minutes and getting laughs consistently for 5 minutes was a big thing. And then it's 10 minutes, then it's 20, and you can't conceive of doing an hour.
Yeah.
And now an hour is like, well, I'll come up with a new 90 minutes every year and kind of roll it out. And it just becomes, you know, it's self-help. It's the weight doesn't get lighter, your back gets stronger.
Yeah.
You just get better at it. And it's, I think, it's very process-driven. And that kind of leads to, you know, it's you get better at the process, you get better at doing it, doing the thing.
And when you say that it's sort of binary in the sense that people either laugh or they don't laugh, what if some of them are pissed off, as they frequently are at your specials? And
No one's ever pissed off at the special. No. That's the illusion, is that people are offended at the show.
Right.
No.
People
out there are offended. People like, okay, the Netflix special drops this week. So Natural Born Killer, go and watch it on Netflix, streaming now. People, there'll be controversy this week. I'll get cancelled this week.
Yes.
Because it's escaped the lab.
Yeah.
The jokes that people
brought. Right, I see.
1.2 million people came to see the tour. They're all fine.
Right.
No complaints.
Right.
And
it'll
then
come
suddenly,
out and someone's
going to
be picketing on Netflix.
And someone goes through and goes, this is disgraceful.
So I'll tell you, I just Googled you before coming on to see what. All right. So all right, let me show you.
Well, I'm in trouble for
so
now.
So we're now probably like 4 or 5 weeks prior to the release of the special. And this is the first page of Google results for Jimmy Carr. Metro.co.uk. Jimmy Carr's vile joke leaves deaf woman outraged. This
How
is
did
from
she
two
hear
days
it?
Ago. New York Post.
Who told her?
From 6 hours ago. Comedian Jimmy Carr's vile joke at deaf audience member causes outrage. Quote, this isn't comedy, unquote. Daily Star. Jimmy Carr branded vile after mocking deaf member of his audience from one day ago. Kent Online. I love reading Kent Online.
Kent Online.
Kent Online.
I'm getting dragged by Kent Online.
Deaf woman.
You should pronounce Kent.
Insulted. It's pronounced Kent.
Kent.
Okay, K-E-N-T.
Yeah. Written by Kents for Kents.
By Jimmy Carr's jokes about her at Kent Show. GB News. Jimmy Carr defended amid backlash as deaf audience member insulted by vile jokes. Daily Mail Online. Army veteran left profoundly deaf by cargo lorry crash. Claims Jimmy Carr targeted her disability in vile joke.
The Mirror, Jimmy Carr Show, Brandon Vile. This is the first page.
Yeah, yeah, but, you know.
So,
but, yeah,
you know. Okay. And then there's one, which is Chortle saying, woman who buys ticket to offensive comedian stunned to find he's offensive, which is perhaps a more charitable way of putting it. But this, so this happens reasonably frequently.
Yes, but I think you have to right-size it. I think you have to right-size it. You have to say, well, look, I told a joke and some people didn't like it. That's as serious as it is.
Right.
Okay. Like, you can catastrophize, and I like
to. But there seems to be quite a lot of catastrophizing going on at the moment.
Yeah, good luck. Right. What do you want me to do?
Well, people will get angry at you on Twitter.
Yeah. You can... Don't look at it. Don't look at it. Turn it off. I think people do get a little bit obsessive about, you know, the idea of, like, that's not a cancellation, that's a complaint.
Right.
And I think there's a big difference. Like, if someone has a problem with a joke, okay. I'm not for everyone. I would say there are 50 jokes in that show. I do know that show. That's the new one. It was a preview of the new show.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally just happened.
There are 50 jokes that are worse than that in the show.
Right.
You have no right to be offended by that joke.
Right.
Because what about the ones that came before and after?
Well, let me tell you.
Here's some edgy stuff.
Here's the last thing that I'll say about this. The individual who was offended, apparently, this is all based on this one individual being offended,
right,
says, it's just not acceptable. Jimmy doesn't need to do that. He's rich enough.
Mm.
Are you rich enough?
I don't know if I got paid any extra for insulting the deaf. There's no extra.
I like the idea that you get to a point of wealth and success.
Okay,
you should be. Well,
my sense of humor.
Obviously, I can't say the funny things that I think are funny because I've got enough money now. So I have to talk about anodyne things.
But it's the idea of that a joke is a punch somehow, or that it's attacking someone. You know, a joke should be inclusive. It should be fun. And I like to think of myself as kind of an equal opportunities offender. And the idea that you go, oh, that sacred cow, the thing that offends me, you can't joke about. But the jokes in the show about rape or paedophilia or famine or disease.
Not things to be joked about, Jimmy Carr.
But all of the other stuff, all the other stuff's fine.
Right.
It's that one that's the problem.
Specific one.
So, and I can understand that. And you go, and sometimes it's very well-meaning and you go, a charity gets involved. And they go, well, we're the charity, and our job is to publicise this issue. And he's a very famous comedian, and Netflix are involved, and this is great. We can get some traction out of this, and so there's a story. And whether you view that as free publicity or you view that as a career-ending thing, the first time it happens to you, it's a little bit scary. Mm. And some cancellations are worse than others. Sometimes it's like politicians commenting, or you're on the front of the paper, or, you know, the prime ministers at the G20 talking about your tax affairs. There's different levels. And it's great in one way because it's a... you find out who your friends are.
Mm-hmm.
You find who stands with you and who doesn't. And that can be... it's a valuable lesson, but it's painful sometimes because sometimes people that you wouldn't have thought would be your guy absolutely had your back. And sometimes people really let you down. Mm-hmm. And you think, oh, well, you threw me under the bus. Okay.
Who threw you under the bus, Jimmy?
I've had some people throwing me under the bus, yeah.
Have you?
But you go, it's okay, it's a lesson learned. And it's that thing of, you know, I don't think your friends necessarily have to stand with you, like 100%. But I do think they have to not publicly throw you under the bus.
Well, yeah, well, they should stand with the principle that jokes are jokes.
Yeah.
At the very least. If they work in comedy, one would imagine.
You would have thought. I mean, actually, I think there's a big difference now between being cancelled over something you did and a joke you made, something you said. And I think actually the way the world is at the moment, it just seems very true. I can't imagine. It tends to be a slow news week when these things catch fire.
Yeah, right.
Whereas normally it's like, I don't know. What do you want?
One of the quotes from the person who was offended says, comedy is an amazing tool for progressive change. Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. I think there's something very true about that. The idea that the comedy is sort of like a canary in the mine. If you look at like, Jerry Seinfeld stopped playing the universities in America about 10 years ago.
Mm.
He said, I'm not playing the university campus anymore. They're a bit too sensitive.
Yeah.
That was the canary in the mine.
Right.
That was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And going, these people are being crazy.
Do you remember his gag that they were upset about?
What was the
he had a gag
How
about...
How could they be upset at Seinfeld?
I know. He had a gag about young people scrolling through Instagram and just scrolling through Tinder or one of these dating apps or something. And he said that they're kind of just scrolling and checking it and selecting and yes or knowing like a gay prince or something.
Yeah.
It was that mild. And they were like,
that's a homophobic, it's also an anti-royalist slur, perhaps, but, or like, I think he's a gay French prince or something like that. He was just saying that these people are behaving in an entitled fashion.
Right.
And,
but
yeah, that was
yeah,
it.
But I mean, if you're, okay.
Yeah.
If you're offended by that, great.
I know. How
great.
Many gay good French luck. Princes
good
are
luck.
There?
Good luck in the world. Good luck in the world, though, because it's
I know.
You know, if you're that brittle.
Yeah. Do you use social media, personally?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I quite like, I think it's an incredible kind of tool, and everyone's got a voice, and it strikes me that's a very good thing. And then sometimes people get upset because you go, because everyone's got a voice, and everyone's got an opinion.
Right.
So I think something that would have been an eye roll and a tut is now a tweet.
Yes.
And then I think the press want you to believe that the press opinion, Twitter, and public opinion are the same thing.
Right.
And you can be fooled. Like, I've been cancelled and then gone out in front of 2,000 people that night and gone, I think I'm fine.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I think,
yeah.
Weirdly,
they don't seem very cancelling.
I spent the whole day thinking it was over for me, and then this is fine. Jokes still work. People still like the show.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a way to... I mean, I think people spend too much time on social media. I mean, I think there's an issue with it in that people are living for children. I think for us, it's fine. I grew up in a world without social media and formed my personality without it. Now, I think it's dangerous for kids because it strikes me that there's no freedom for kids in real life and total freedom online. And that's a social experiment that I don't think we should have conducted.
When you say no freedom in real life, do you mean because we're...
I mean sort of the coddling of the American mind, this idea that kids aren't allowed to go to the shops anymore on their own. Like, a 14-year-old now needs a babysitter. A 14-year-old used to be a babysitter.
Mm.
That's a weird change in the world. And what's happened to 14-year-olds? Well, nothing. How much freedom should they have? Well, as much as they can cope with.
Mm. Mm.
And it strikes me that thing of going, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. There's you can either protect a child and physically, and that's the upside is that child's absolutely safe, but mentally... will be very vulnerable.
Mm, so not resilient.
You've got to find a balance. So how do you build resilience? You can't have an easy life and a great character.
Right.
Can't be done. And life is kind of self-assignment, isn't it? Life is going out and finding your adventure and finding the thing that you want to sort of test your mettle on. And you know, you're sort of putting yourself through hard times to build character. And we're not allowing kids to do that. So online, they can do anything they want. They can be whoever they want. But the problem is there's no sort of pushback there. So you go, well, who are we? You know, what is, you know, the self has become something that is self-curated. And it used to be that it was like, well, you are who you are, and it's mediated by your friends and family and the greater sort of, you know, society. Yeah, there's a little bit of pushback.
Mm.
If you go, well, I think I'm an incredibly good-looking quarterback, then the rest of society goes, no. No, you're a funny little fella. You can have to kind of mediate that a little bit.
And on that scale of resilience and freedom on the one hand versus safety and vulnerability on the other, what was your childhood like?
Well, we were pretty, I think we were allowed to kind of, it was fairly, fairly good in terms of being allowed freedom, being allowed to kind of just go off and do whatever you were going to do and explore the world. So I think, yeah, good. I think that was a good thing.
Did it build your character?
I think it does, yeah. I think it's, you know, that thing of going, Chris Rock's got a great routine about it where he sent these, you've seen this routine where he sent his kids to school and they said there's no bullying in the school? Well, you're only doing half the job.
That's right.
How are they going to know? Because in the real world, there's you know, a certain amount of that. So there's, and really, I think we seek out bullies. Like, if you think about, if you have a personal trainer, it's a bully, isn't it? It's basically a bully.
Mm.
I mean, he's, you know, he doesn't say it specifically, but if you have a personal trainer, they'll sort of look at you like, All right, fatty boom boom. Maybe some sit-ups today.
Mine's a very aggressive Polish lady, who I call the Polish bear. So she's a bully.
Yeah, but you're slightly looking for that, right?
Yeah,
slightly
absolutely.
Looking for someone that will push you.
Yeah.
And not make things too easy.
It's interesting. I mean, I also think this, you know, I know you've got a son and I've got kids who are not at a dissimilar age. And I do sometimes wonder, like, you know, when you're trying to teach them not to punch other kids in the playground at school, it would be a lot simpler if it were, we still lived in an era where when they do that, they got clunked in the head by somebody. But they don't have that feedback mechanism anymore. So you have to sort of tell them and send them to, you know, therapists to try and get them to, deal with their anger management.
There's a balance here, right?
I would occasionally like it if my children got slapped. That's all I'm saying, Jimmy.
Yeah.
And no, not by me.
Yeah.
Not by me, by another child.
No, it's...
slightly larger than them.
Yeah, what they need is their own podcast. They'll be fine.
Exactly, that's right. And the other thing about social media, I mean, it's interesting that you say curation, because that's...
It makes more sense, social media, if you view it as performative.
Yeah.
It is a performance, and people are on there performing. Mm. And if you view it as a communication method, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
So I think there is something about, like, it's a very performative medium.
And the fact that we're always sort of... I mean, I do wonder what's happening as you sort of... You look at the beautiful sunset, and instead of appreciating the beautiful sunset, you think about what a great Instagram photo that's going to make. Or you have a thought and you think, well, that would make a good tweet. Or you have an argument in your head and you think that could be good to put... And it's like you've got a little version of yourself who's sitting on your shoulder saying, oh, that'd be good. So it's a constant ongoing process of self-curation, where instead of being in the moment, we're always thinking about our own lives as if it's fodder for the self-representation that we're creating on social.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's clearly an issue, because you're sort of living for this sort of legacy, this almost kind of idealized version of yourself that lives online.
Yeah.
And people are now going to plastic surgeons, and instead of bringing a picture of a movie star, they bring a picture of themselves with a filter on it and go, I want to look like that. But really...
Right.
Like, it's kind of nonsense. I mean, it strikes me that there's a couple of things going on with sort of our lives online, where if you look at what's happening with young men, they're playing video games. And video games are a proxy for a career. Mm. And if you look at how video games work, they literally different levels and different levels of competence, and then you have a big boss at the end. It's a career that you're not having because you're looking at this. And people are looking at porn... And they're not having sex because they're getting their dopamine hits so cheap. So it strikes me that it's George Orwell wasn't right, Aldous Huxley was right. It's we are giving up our freedom, not because there's some authoritarian leader trying to take our freedom away. We're giving it away for cheap dopamine, for cheap thrills. And those things of going, well, how do you, like, the message of, like, don't look at internet porn isn't a strong enough message.
Mm.
It should go and get your dick wet, son. That should be the message. Like, but take risks. It's risk. It's like sports are better than video games, and a career is better than sports. Like, but there's skin in the game, and there's risk, and it's difficult. But as you do that, you build kind of resilience, and you grow. So there are people that put so many thousands of hours into, I don't know, Call of Duty or Vice City or whatever they're playing.
I share all of these concerns, and then sometimes I just turn around and I think, well, newsflash, middle-aged, middle-class guy thinks that things were better when he was growing up.
Well, they used to say this these days. You know, they used to say this about novels.
Yeah.
150 exactly. years ago,
people. Or went, television.
They're just sitting around reading.
Or radio. Exactly.
They
right.
should be out there building an empire.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
Do you ever wonder whether our criticisms of what's going on are just what happens to you when you're your age?
No, I don't think there's... I mean, I think the idea that people are watching too much porn and not fucking enough and not having kids, that's a problem.
It's independently true.
That is a problem. And that's, you know, our destiny is caught up in that. So, yeah, that's going to be a problem. Right. And the idea that having a career is as valid as Call of Duty. No, I'm right about that.
Right.
They're like, they're fun things, but they're, the dose is the issue. Social media is amazing. Video games are incredible. Porn, fabulous. The dose is maybe the problem.
Right. And what dose of porn do you enjoy, Jimmy?
Well, the daily recommended allowance.
Right.
Yeah. No, I finished in the first lockdown. I finished Pornhub.
Right. Is that right? You got to the end of it.
Yeah, I put my initials in.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. I didn't know there was an end.
Yeah. It just comes up on the screen. It just says rehydrate.
Speaking of coming to an end of a website.
Coming to an end is great.
Coming to an end. Speaking of coming to an end, this is going to go in interesting directions. Did you know when Facebook began and there was no like button and there was no ability to share things and there was no algorithm behind it? It was just a reverse chronological list of of things that your friends had posted. You could get to the end and there was no infinite scroll. So the infinite scroll was something that they actually invented, that engineers at Facebook invented. But you used to be able to get to the end of Facebook
Well, and then you were just like, oh,
and that's it.
Might have a cup of tea, finish Facebook.
I'm done. Isn't that cute? Isn't that
quaint? It's a lovely idea.
You know, I think that's all the things your friends have posted lately.
But I think there was a year. I forget what year it was. I think it was the Library of Alexandria. There was a year, the last year, when you could have read everything ever written.
Right. Like, there were in only, a human lifetime.
They were only like, like a couple of thousand books, and you could have read them all.
Yeah.
Before your eyes gave up on you because there weren't glasses yet.
Right.
In that year.
And that total amount of data now gets created purely in pornography every second.
Yes. Well, there's a weird fact, isn't there, about the something like 95% of what's consumed online was made within the last 24 hours.
Yeah.
And will be forgotten in the next 24 hours.
Yeah. It's so like
there's this concept of like Lindy books. You aware of this concept? It's quite a good concept. So the idea of like, the length of a piece of media will probably be projected into the future, how long it's lasted in the past.
Right.
So if you take Orwell's 1984, you go, well, that was written in 1948. It's lasted this long. So it's lasted 75 years. So it'll probably still be relevant in 75 years' time. That's worth reading. No one ever goes, let me show you my favorite TikTok from last March. Mm,
yeah, that's right.
It's just gone. It's just forgotten. It's throwaway. So the idea of like reading things that really matter is, it's quite easy to find those lists as well of like these are important good things.
Mm. It's a permanent kind of now, in a way. It's like we're all just living in a detached now, state of nowness,
like where we're sharing a Ballard novel, isn't it? It's like that,
sharing and consuming. Yeah, it's kind of dystopian with no kind of anchors to the past and no particular planning for the future. It's just like, this is what I'm seeing right now that I want to share with you because it happens to have scratched some dopamine itch.
Yeah, but then there's real stuff going on as well. There's real stuff going on. It's like, why do people want to go to concerts? Why do people want to go to comedy shows? There's a weird sense of like people want to belong. They want to feel a part of something. I certainly think at a comedy show, it's like people laugh a lot more when they're in the room than watching it on a screen.
Yeah.
You know, watching the new special on the headphones on the bus to work is great. And you may well think that's very funny. That is a very well-constructed joke. Well done, Jimmy. But you won't laugh in the same way you laugh when you're with friends at a show with 1,000 strangers and it's tribal.
Mm.
Why do people all want to go to music festivals and sing along? Mm. It's tribal. It feels fantastic to be part of that group. It's a really beautiful, I think there's people are longing for that, I think.
Yeah.
Because they're looking at screens all day long. You get up in the morning, you check your phone, and then you check the sat nav in the car, and you get into the office and you look at the screen, and when you take 5 minutes off, you look at your phone. Screen, 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 screen. And then suddenly you want to go and be part of something.
Do people ever film you while you're on stage?
Constantly.
Like, hold up their phones?
Constantly, yeah.
Does it bother you?
No. Fine. I mean, as long as once every 3 years, Netflix sends some cameras and a bag of cash, fine.
You're fine with that.
Fine.
And in terms of permanence, and, you know, so 1984 having an expected life expectancy of 150 years or whatever it might be, you're in a profession which is impermanent. It is about the creating that moment. You have that moment with the crowd.
It is, but it's very new. Comedy's very new. Comedy doesn't even have a language yet. I'm kind of working on something on this at the moment. But comedy, really, if you trace back its roots, you can go back to the trickster gods, Skunk Anansie and all of that. But really, I'd say 69-70, if you look at maybe Richard Pryor and George Carlin as John the Baptist, these guys come along and they start selling out shows where it's just them talking for sort of an hour and a half, 2 hours, and being hilarious. And they've come from the nightclubs, but they're doing an hour and a half, they're playing like rock stars in these venues, and people are coming to see them, and they're looking at them, and they're saying something very interesting. There's no filter. You know, if you really think about what friendship is, like really good friends, you've got no filter.
Mm.
Work colleagues, you've got a bit of filter. Strangers, you've got a lot of filter. But comics, it's no filter. It's sort of direct with them. It's like a friendship. And then as things progress through the 70s, 80s, 90s, it's getting better. It's getting more relevant. I'd say it's more relevant today than it's ever been. So I'm kind of working on a thing at the moment on teaching stand-up comedy because it strikes me that it's more relevant than music. Like music is nonverbal communication and it's incredibly important to me and it anchors an emotion within you or can anchor emotions within you that are just, it's phenomenal, right? Music, but it's not as relevant as stand-up comedy. Think about it, if you taught a kid, if you could give a child a gift, they say, well, I'm going to teach him stand-up comedy. Well, what's he going to learn? Well, he's going to learn his own voice. He's going to find his own voice. He's going to learn how to order and write down his thoughts. And then he's going to learn how to express himself to other people and connect to them. That's what. That's all he's going to learn from stand-up comedy. Yeah, put me down for one of those. And you really, you think about the tragedy is most people live and die and they never hear their own voice. And stand-up comedy, at its best, is teaching people to express themselves. And yes, it's one facet of their personality. It's about being funny and it's about making people laugh. Isn't that a joyful thing?
Mm.
I think it's got a real potential. So I'm trying to write the language of comedy. I'm trying to write the joke types and the almost like music has a language and you can...
Do you mean like write an instruction manual?
Yeah.
Sort of, for stand-up?
Yeah. Like, no, but that's the aim. Well, the aim is to kind of... I'm not sure if it's really about giving something back, but it's about... It strikes me as a very useful thing to do with my time.
Yeah.
And it's also, I hear something, I forget it. I read something, I remember it. I teach something, I know it.
Mm.
So I want to teach it. It's for me, really. Like if I can teach it, if I can sort of do it in a way that people can go, oh, well, look, I'm not a fan of his comedy, but the guy knows what jokes are.
Mm.
And he could teach me how to write jokes. Because sometimes I see people and they're brilliant. They've got great stage presence and they've got a great story. And you go, yeah, but you've got one joke in it.
Right.
And it's, you need to, you could do more.
Yeah.
But you don't have the language.
Mm.
It's not like you're not being lazy. You just, it's, you're chopping through the jungle with a machete. And I'm saying, well, I'm going to build a highway.
Yeah. I mean, I think the craft of writing jokes is fascinating. But I mean, I'm still interested in your attitude towards not the relevance of comedy, but just the posterity point that you made earlier. Like, do you worry about... What do you think about death and, like, what the world is going to make of Jimmy Carr after Jimmy Carr's gone? Like, long-term, do you care about legacy? Like, remember Woody Allen's old line about, like, you know, I don't want to achieve immortality through my films. I want to achieve immortality by not dying.
I'll take that. I'll raise you Mark Twain. Mark Twain said, I was not alive for billions of years before my birth, and it caused me not the slightest inconvenience. We're in a brief shaft of light between two oceans of darkness. Great. We get to die and we're the lucky ones. As we get to live. Like, it's so... I view it as like gratitude is the mother of all virtues. But the idea of legacy is slightly caught up with heaven. In a secular world, fame... you know, rich and famous replaces heaven, right? It's the land of milk and honey. It's the future, and I think it's great. It kind of works. I like being rich and famous, but I don't think it's the answer necessarily.
You were raised religious.
Yeah, raised Catholic.
Is there a difference?
Yeah, it's better. I mean, like, the God I don't believe in is the real one.
Fabulous, great. And what made you lose your faith?
Well, I suppose it's like, it's always a mix of things, but it was the, if I'm right, you're wrong. You know, hey, it's good news. That's always the thing in the Bible. It's good news. Not for you, Ishmael.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not Tarek, not you.
Yeah.
Just good news for us.
Yes.
The rest of you can. So that thing of like, that's very difficult to circle that square. I think it's weird. My favorite quote on religion at the moment is the, it's AC/DC's
Great Australian roadie. Band. Thank you very much.
AC/DC's roadie. Right. Said this. Who knew? He said, God is the name we give to the sheet. We throw over the mystery to give it shape.
Was the roadie Eckhart Tolle?
It's kind of great, though, isn't it?
It's great.
Because you go, yeah, there's a huge mystery. No one knows why we're here. And some people go, well, I call that mystery Jesus or Muhammad or whatever you want to do. And then you go, and some of us go, well, science. But there's two kinds of idiots. There's some people that take religion literally and they believe fairy stories. And there's other people that think it's got no value at all. Both crazy. You know, the rituals all work. But the rituals don't work because God's pleased. The rituals work because people bond and they come together and they feel part of something. I went to see Depeche Mode last week in Paris. Genuinely a religious experience. Genuine, like the sing-along and actually all of their stuff is kind of because of what religious undertones anyway. But so beautiful and so lovely. So you find it where you find it.
Do you still have religious, do you still participate in religious rituals? Like, no. Do you miss that? I mean, yeah. Part of the, yeah.
I miss it. I miss the, it's nice. It's nice to think, isn't it? It's nice to think.
Well, even without the think, the traditions, there's something, I mean, I've never been a religious person, but
you know, the Muslim call to prayer or the huge Greek Orthodox churches or the just the way of kind of creating artistic reverence for life in a way that transcends the everyday, a way of punctuating our lives with particular ceremonies so that when you die, this happens, and when you get married, this happens, and when there's a birth, this happens.
Well, the ceremonies, I mean, they do it very, very well.
They're good at it.
Yeah.
They're good at it. And I wonder.
And they do certain things much better than secular society.
Yes.
We do forgiveness. Good luck with that, cancel culture.
Right. Right.
There's no, because we live in an everlasting now. Whatever you said that was the offensive, terrible thing is the offensive, terrible thing forever. Mm. And there's no way back.
Yeah.
It's not great. It's not a great system.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to kind of recommend it, but it's,
I just wonder whether we need secularized versions of that. I mean, do you think in a couple of hundred years we'll have secular, I don't know, ways of framing community and life events?
But do we not have that now with the self-help stuff or whatever, talking about Eckhart Tolle or something, the idea of going, it's a way of framing the world, a way of kind of looking at the world and a sense of community. People are finding their own communities. I mean, the other great thing about, we talked about the downsides of social media and online life, but the upside is you find a community there. You find other people that kind of have the same mindset as you and you come together. That's a lovely thing. Or people come out to a comedy show and they feel part of something and they enjoy the experience and then they go off.
Yeah.
It's the sort of pathological worship of the individual is maybe slightly an issue.
Right.
And has been since sort of the early 70s, when sort of the left sort of gave up and started doing yoga. That's what happened really politically in the early 70s. And you go, it was the worship of the individual rather than the group.
Mm.
Something's missing a little bit.
Didn't that unleash a huge amount of creativity and, I don't know, individualism and interesting stuff?
No solutions, only trade-offs. Yeah, there's great stuff, and then there's downsides.
Yeah, yeah.
There's downsides to it. So there's, the world changes. I mean, I'm very positive about the world. I sort of think, things are terrible. They're just better than they've ever been.
Yeah, yeah. It's like democracy is the worst political system apart from all the others, isn't it?
Yeah, and capitalism's awful, other than anything else you can think of.
That's right. You mentioned the magic word, cancel culture. Where are we on that? Do you think we're getting better or worse?
I think it's the same as it ever was, right? The words you can and can't say change over time. And it was much worse, I think, in the old days. I think it was much worse in the 1970s when you couldn't sort of make jokes about the church and you couldn't make jokes about paedophilic priests or you couldn't make jokes about these things that would be pretty acceptable now to make jokes about.
Yeah.
But it changes and it's like language. It's language is kind of the greatest example of anarchy in the world, right? There's no system that tells us how to speak English, and it ebbs and flows and changes. So every 50 years, if you took a snapshot of the English language, it's changed. And somehow that's just happened.
Isn't that part? I mean, you sound a little bit like the people who sort of defend cancel culture, who are on the kind of social justice left, in the sense that they say, look, it's not cancel culture, it's consequence culture. We're just trying to hold people accountable. Well, it's accountability, right? Norms change. Well, but you, Jimmy Carr, spent puncturing those.
Yeah, but
norms.
there's the idea of it depends how you define cancel culture. So if it's an ad hominem argument against someone, if you go, well, we it's not about the argument. With comedy, I think it's weird because it's never an argument; it's a joke. So they go, you can go against someone's argument, or you can go against the individual. If you go against the individual and say, well, he must never work again, and you call for him to resign, and you say that anyone that defends him is also guilty of the same crime, well, that's cancel culture. And that's there's a language around that I do not subscribe to. I mean, the idea of a slightly Maoist sort of language around thought crimes and unconscious bias. Unconscious bias? What, so I don't even know that I'm biased against this. It's straight out of Mao's playbook. It's disgraceful. That's that. And then there's people getting upset about jokes and certain things push buttons. And I think it's sort of the comedian's job, or certainly my job, is to kind of go, well, I'll navigate that. I'll sort of, in a world where censorship doesn't come from above, it's about self-censorship. So people don't talk in the office openly. Why did you leave ABC? Because you didn't feel, you felt that you were self-censoring within a great media organization. You had a great job, great colleagues, great people around you, and you went, oh, no, I want to do a podcast because I don't want to self-censor anymore. I want to speak freely. And you spoke freely, and people are drawn to you now because you're speaking freely. I feel like I'm doing the same thing. I feel like I'm on stage. I'm speaking freely. I'm saying what you want to say. And it's not about agreeing with the point. It's just the freedom. It's the luxuriating in the freedom of saying anything and getting laughs on it. And it's, you know, you only laugh at the bad thing because you know what the good thing is. You know what it's meant to be. So you can laugh. And it's very cathartic to be in that space because comedy lives between public and private discourse. And really, I mean, the reason you're in new media is because you know there's never been a bigger gap between how people talk on the news and how people talk in the real world, in their houses, in bars, with their friends.
What's caused that, do you think?
I think there's a certain amount of fear. There's a certain amount of, you know, if you want to see who's really powerful in society, what can't you say? And I would put it at the feet of the neo-Marxists. I would say that when I was at college, I was very interested in that stuff. You know, Foucault and Adorno and Lyotard and Marcuse and all of those kind of big names on the left that were saying, oh, you know, Marxism, it's not about class. It's not about money. It's not about capital. It's about power. It's an interesting thought, but it's escaped the lab. That's taken over now. And so there's this weird sort of, people are sort of worried about saying anything because they think, well, what about the power dynamic? Well, that's not the only factor.
Mm.
It's a weird irony that Marxism has entirely left behind the core idea, which is that economic inequality is a problem.
Yeah.
I didn't seem to give a fuck about that.
Well, and the left has as well. I mean, not just Marxists, but even the centre-left.
The centre-left, I mean, really, the reason I think the Labour and the Democrats in the States lost the recent elections that they lost is because they abandoned the working classes. It's madness. There's no voice for the working class.
Mm. Were you a lefty when you were young?
Yeah. I would say I'm very sort of centrist now, with a Salt Bay of libertarian. A little bit of that on top. Like, I'm very much like, well, should we be involved? The idea that politics should give us some kind of heaven on earth is madness. And I think anything that goes, whether it's religious or whether it's political, that says we have just around the corner heaven for you, you get very quickly to by any means necessary. So you get, like, you know,
but who's saying we have heaven around the corner?
Well, this is the argument on the super far left that we're going to have equality of outcome, which is sort of madness, isn't it? Because there isn't equality of effort and input and all those other things, and the world isn't fair. Equality of opportunity seems to be something that we should be shooting for, you know. But it's classic kind of liberal views. That's sort of what I have.
They would say that, you know, equality of opportunity is all very well, but there are structural impediments to particular groups from getting ahead because there's entrenched racism, homophobia, transphobia, whatever it might be. And until you address the unequal outcomes of particular groups, you're not going to be able to achieve equality of opportunity just by treating everybody equally because some people are coming from a lower position than others.
Okay. What do you want to do? All right, I mean, great, but okay. It'd be lovely if the world was fair. It's not going to be fair, like, because it's nature's not fair. Not everyone's given the same gifts. You know, different people, you know, have different abilities. So there's always going to be hierarchy. Is it going to be just or unjust? That's an interesting question. And I think when you get back to kind of original Marxism, the original brand, still the best, and go, well, actually, we should level up things financially for people, give them equality of opportunity. I mean, I think education is maybe the key point there where you could hope to make a difference. Mm. But
Jimmy Carr, economic Marxist, not cultural Marxist.
Yeah, that seems about right, doesn't it?
First, sure it does. And on the question of taboos and cancel culture, like, it's sort of neat to divide it into cancel culture is beyond the pale when you're trying to get somebody fired for making a joke about something. But then, on the other hand, it's good to, you know, sort of stir the pot.
Well, I'm freedom of speech, so if they want to try and get me fired, have at it, I say.
Right.
If you want to protest,
right. You go.
But
I'm interested in, because your critics would say, well, but, you know, a whole part of your persona and a whole part of your act is about intentionally picking at the scabs or puncturing the taboos that we're trying to set up. So there's this forward march of
progress. There's this vanguard of what is okay and what is not okay. You go back to the 1950s and you see how casually racist and sexist everybody was, presumably in another 50 years' time. Well, it's 70 years now since the 50s. Yeah. People going to be joke, more enlightened.
The joke that ends my career, I've already told it. I can relax, can't I? It's out there somewhere on YouTube or Netflix, and I probably told it 15 years ago, and it didn't cause any fuss. But someone's going to do the, outrage archaeology job and go back and find it at some point and be offended. Okay.
Right.
I'll wear it. I said it, you know.
Right.
I didn't say it by accident. I said it, got a big laugh. I had fun with it.
The weird thing is that you didn't say it in the cultural context of today, which is what's so weird about outrage archaeology, that, you know, you're talking about an era when, you know, when Kevin Hart was uninvited from hosting the Academy Awards because he'd tweeted a homophobic tweet a decade before. He was tweeting that at a time when it was kind of a bit okay. Well, that was the allegation.
The gag was it was a joke about his son being gay. Or if my son was gay, okay.
I think it was if my son was gay, I'd kill him or something.
Yeah.
Mildly homophobic, perhaps. But nonetheless, there is a weird thing where you have to not only be conscious about who you're offending today, but who you might offend in 15 years' time.
Do you have to be conscious of
the mores of...
Do you have to?
Well, that's... But
or
that's,
can you or can you just roll them dice?
But that's what the social justice warriors would say. They'd say, well, so, you know...
But they're not coming to the show.
But there's not... But no, they would say nobody... Jimmy's complaining, and, you know, Josh complaining about cancel culture.
Fine.
But, you know, you look at how successful Jimmy is. You can say these things. People say, oh, you can't say this, you can't say that these days. Of course you do. People say them all the time. Conservatives say them in the press. People, you know, Fox News says them. Lovehearts on television say things all the time.
I'll lump myself in with that lot.
But you know what I mean. There are people say, oh, you can't even question, I don't know, you know, the transgender orthodoxy or something like that. Well, and the trans activists will say, people do it all the time.
That's the opening line of the special. People say, you will have heard this, people say, you can't joke about anything these days. Watch me now.
Yeah.
It's an hour of that.
Yeah.
It's an hour of that. And really, the thing in the special, the thing I have in Natural Born Killers about sort of cancel culture is, I've got a plan for next time. Next time I get cancelled, right? So next time I get cancelled, I'm going to come out on the day of the cancellation, the day the news story breaks, I'm going to make a public statement. I've rehearsed it. I'm going to say, I'm sorry. And the people that I've offended will say, well, you don't really mean that apology. And I'll say, so you're saying I can say something and not mean it. Now you're getting it.
Yeah.
It's jokes. You'll be fine. And,
but I mean, one thing that the media is doing at the moment that aggravates me enormously is they don't seem to have understood that social media backlashes and kind of mobs are not news necessarily. Let me give you an example here.
It's bad faith.
Like, totally.
Have you ever hung out with journalists? I know you have.
I have.
Yeah. Okay.
Occasionally was one.
Journalists, right? Quite a nice bunch.
Yeah.
Let's be honest about it, right? Quite a nice bunch.
Yeah.
You would want to go for a beer with them.
Yeah.
They're fun journalists. Mm. And are they the most PC people in the world? Not in my experience.
No.
No. There's quite a lot of bullying in a newsroom, and they're quite a fun bunch, and they use language liberally. Okay? When you read what they were, I was outraged.
It's extraordinary.
Were you outraged?
Yeah. Please. Well, they don't even say they were outraged. What they do is they'll find two people on Twitter who were outraged.
Yeah.
Here's one, Mr. Carr, that's you.
Yes.
Was recently branded painfully unfunny by viewers after he shared a selection of his controversial jokes from his Netflix show to plug his US tour. And it says...
Painfully unfunny, that's...
It says...
That's harsh.
This is the one they're basing this on. One person on X, formerly known as Twitter, in case you didn't know what X was, wrote, God, that was so bad, and he fell off so bad, what is this? The joke were so bad, said another. These were so cringe. So two people have commented on Twitter.
Well, both of them, though, with degrees in English.
And the Daily Mail has written up a piece
on
the basis of...
You
have the patience of a saint, Jimmy.
But someone's going to see that and go, oh, Jimmy Carr's on tour. You get a ticket for that. But... Like someone's gonna like it's yeah. it's gonna have some positive effect or
yeah.
someone will go all right did he
like and then I go on what basis are they writing an article about this? Is it two tweets?
Yeah,
and I go that doesn't seem like very new. Are there other things that they can write about? There must be other stuff going on, surely.
But really,
apparently not.
Yeah,
well, not according to your Daily Mail.
It's all right though, isn't it?
It's fine.
It's fine.
But you're about to get, you just have been, depending on when this goes out.
Well, this will go out when you're... Yeah, so I will have just come off the back of a Douglas Murray tour.
And people will be upset. But, you know, I think that thing about... It's nice that people have the right to protest.
To hear the rest of this conversation, go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com/listen and you will get your own personal premium podcast feed with at least 3 extra episodes of the podcast every month and heaps of extra stuff, including the remainder right now of the fabulous conversation you've just been hearing. If it was worth listening to this much of, don't rob yourself of the rest. Pull out your phone right now and search for Uncomfortable Conversations with Substack.